Good morning. I'm home with good lighting, good audio. It's a nice change, isn't it? A little bit of jet lag left. I'm doing this quite late. It's 10:15 in the morning because I slept until 9 a.m., which is really, really unusual for someone who normally gets up at 5 a.m. most days. So there is definitely a touch of the jet lag left. But at least I'm back with everything else working properly. So that's the end of Europe. I came to you a week ago from Athens. I'm losing track of time. When was it? I think Monday. Monday we came home for probably the longest journey I've ever had. And because of the screwiness of airline tickets and the way things get booked, we had to go from Athens to Oslo, which is 4 hours, hang around in Gardermoen in Oslo for 4 hours again, fly back over Athens to Dubai, so 4 hours back over Athens, another 3.5 hours or something to Dubai, hang around there for a few hours, and then another 13 hours home. So we're 36 hours door-to-door. This is possibly why I'm feeling tired now. A large part of why I'm feeling tired now. Now, where do we begin? What do I normally do here? Sponsors. Let's do sponsors. Sponsors, same sponsor as last week, brand new sponsor last week, is Push Security, stopping identity theft with browser-based agent that detects and protects against account takeover. Try it for free. Touch of the jet lag left. Push is a browser-based agent that detects and prevents identity breaches. I think we're going to have a lot of identity breaches in this weekly update today, or things related to identity being handed over to unintended third parties. Identities are the new perimeter. Fair point. Identity attacks are now the number one threat. It's the cascading effects of identity attacks, which are so fascinating. Attack TTPs are rapidly evolving. Find out more about Scattered Spider. We'll come back to them. Octojacking and Evil Twin integrations. This is a very unplanned but very synergistic time to have this sponsor in this week's update. Big thanks to Push Security for their sponsorship of TroyHunt.com and this video and all the related things. All right, who's here? Eddie, finally going to catch one live. Welcome, Eddie. Daniel's the joys of traveling. Coming back the other way. Charlotte was saying the other day, she said, West is best and East is a beast, you know, because it's easier going West. Now, what I've heard before is that your circadian rhythm is just a little bit longer than 24 hours. So when you go West and you're going with the sun and the days become longer, it's kind of a little bit closer to where your natural body clock is. But when you go the other way and the days are shorter, it's even further away, and that's what makes things hard. But then I was like, but what if you're just going to the exact other side of the world? It doesn't matter, does it? It's the same duration of travel, but maybe because you're going with the sun. Anyway, I just always find that coming back this way is the worst. Now, if I go to the US and I come back this way, no problem, because I'm going west. Australia's on the other side. But yeah. James, strange day for Troy. Travel. Stefan's here. G'day, Stefan. I do want to come visit you too, mate. That's west. Iceland is west, so maybe we'll do this. Lance, Marek, Simon, James, my circadian rhythm is definitely long. Yeah, apparently. Can you measure it? I don't know. All right, I do have a heap of stuff today to go through, and a bunch of it is related, except for the first thing, which is in trust. Now, this is interesting. I feel like I haven't spoken about TLS for a long time because things have pretty much just gone the way we expected. We've gone more and more secure by default, more and more HTTPS everywhere, more and more free certificate authorities, less and less duration of certificates and more automated. Like everything has been good and everything has been stable. And then yesterday I get up and there's this story about Chrome distrusting Entrust. Now, Entrust is a CA. Let me just come back and talk about it. I'm just going to go back and find the tweets that I have sent, so many tweets over so many years about Entrust. The bottom line here is that Chrome is going to begin removing Entrust as a trusted CA from Chrome. Google is going to begin removing it from Chrome. Very often what happens when a CA is hit with the ban hammer by one browser, the other browsers follow afterwards. I'm not sure in the last 24 hours if that has happened. Maybe Stefan or someone else has seen that. And generally what happens as well, because obviously there's a whole bunch of certificates that have been issued by Entrust that are on perfectly legitimately operating websites, what tends to happen is the browser vendors will say, well, look, certificates issued between everything up until now, no problems. Everything from here to here, you'll start to get interstitial warnings on the browser, and then everything after a certain point just simply won't be trusted. So what Chrome has said here, or Google said, is upcoming changes in Chrome 127. What are we even up to these days? I don't know. I just clicked the relaunch to update button, which I can see here right now, and I get a new version. Where is it? About? Help? About. I'm on 126 at the moment, and I'm ready to update to 127, so we're not far off. TLS server authentication certificates validating to the following Entrust roots whose earliest signed certificate timestamp is dated after October 31 will no longer be trusted by default. In other words, you've got June, July, August, September, October. You've got 4 months from now to stop getting Entrust certificates. At least any of those that chain back to the roots that have been listed here, which I imagine is a lot of them because it's the organization itself whose behavior you're not real happy with. Why is Chrome taking action? Certificate authorities serve a privileged and trusted role on the internet. I mean, it's up to the certificate authority to issue certificates to valid domains such that when you see that domain in your address bar with a certificate, you know with a very high degree of confidence that you're going to that website and your traffic isn't intercepted and read or modified or any of the other things. They play a pivotal cornerstone role in the internet ecosystem. So when you get CAs that maybe don't have the right controls and issue certificates fraudulently to another organization or don't have enough controls to tick all of the CA baseline requirements, which are very, very rigid, that's when they tend to get hit with the hammer here. So these independent encrypted connections between browsers and websites with this tremendous responsibility comes an expectation of adhering to reasonable and consensus-driven security and compliance expectations. This is with great power comes great responsibility. Missed an opportunity there, Chrome. Over the past 6 years, we have observed a pattern of compliance failures, unmet improvement commitments, and the absence of tangible, measurable progress in response to publicly disclosed incident reports. When these factors are considered in aggregate and considered against the inherent risk each publicly trusted CA poses to the internet ecosystem, it is our opinion that Chrome's continued trust of Entrust is no longer justified. Now, there you go. So, there is a long narrative here and a link through to a very long list of bugs that are Entrust related. Holy crap, 59. How long is this over? That goes back to, only 2023. Wow, 59. In what looks like about the last 16 months. Let's talk about the fun bits with Entrust. And I say fun because people like Scott Hell and myself have been hammering them on some of these things for ages. I've got a tweet search here, I'll put it in the tweet thread, about me talking about Entrust. Let's just have a look. Morning, Thomas from New South Wales, catching me live for change. Now, I've got to scroll back past all the mentions of these guys and my name in the last 24 hours. And what have we got here? What if we go to the top ones? Have a look. 2018. Twitter doesn't always put things in order. Entrust has been making claims such as, it is known the EV, probably that EV, is safer than DV without any supporting facts, and then basing phishing prevalence on a nonsensical argument. So that was one of the big things. They were a massive proponent of EV. Remember EV? And I wrote multiple blog posts about EV dying, or for all intents dying, because it's still there. But of course, it's been years and years since you've even seen the organizational name up in the address bar. And Entrust would just keep hammering this position of EV creates trust, therefore please give us money, rather than going to like Let's Encrypt. Just off the top of my head, there was a lot of derogatory stuff about Let's Encrypt as well, which was there for many years, which was very much around trying to preserve their market position because someone was coming and doing what they did for free and doing it better as well. tweet from me here, July 2018. It's a very marketing-centric consortium. This would be the CA Browser Forum, including Komodo and Trust and GoDaddy. Isn't that good company to be in? Komodo and Trust and GoDaddy. And it goes on. Look, there's a whole list here of different incidents over the years of mostly shady marketing. Now, that's going to make it interesting because what does Entrust do now? Now, I'm sure they do many other things. I mean, I assume they do browser signing certificates and so on, and it's not just certificates which are put on websites. But what's curious now is that if you have a look at the go back a couple of links here. If we have a look at the Entrust website, certainly as of yesterday when I screen capped it, the Entrust website says, Entrust keeps the world moving safely by putting secure digital transformation within reach. And then there's the impact. Entrust has issued more than 20 billion payment cards over the first 5 decades. Oh, yeah, I didn't know they did payment cards. Someone said they're owned by MasterCard, which is interesting. So do they like virtual cards or something? Entrust protects more than 100 million workforce and consumer identities. Entrust encrypts and secures more than 24 million Swift messages daily. Well, maybe none of that changes. What's on the Entrust homepage now? Is it entrust.com? It is entrust.com. James has said, I should have said updating Let's Encrypt when they became a trusted root in their own identity. Yes, that was a long time ago now. What about solutions? Are they still pushing certificates? It's interesting. Secure connections, secure data. One of the things I think we've found with commercial CAs is they haven't been real good at keeping up with the industry changes in terms of things like when extended validation certificates disappeared from the UI in the browser. For years after that, years, commercial CAs were still pushing the make sure that you're going to buy an EV because then your identity will be visible to your customers and they will trust you more than if they went to a website that still had the padlock but didn't have an organization name, which was always bullshit. And it was proven as bullshit because once EV disappeared, it's not like websites lost business. You know, it just simply had a padlock there and who knows whether it was EV or OV or DV. Stefan says, I remember having an argument with a PCI auditor about EVs. They asserted that they were more secure and had better cryptography. And I mean, this was one of the massive misunderstandings that was perpetuated by the commercial EV certificate authorities. The underlying cryptography was identical. It makes no difference whatsoever. The only thing that was really different is the barrier to entry in which to obtain one. And there was a trade-off, or rather there was a return on that effort when you used to get the organization name and the address bar. Rephrase it. There was an argument that there was a return on the investment when you got the name because people would see it and they'd trust the website more. But then the name disappeared from the browsers. And of course, that no longer works. Lots of digital certificates. Well, this will be curious. It's been a while since we've had a major CA distrusted. What was the last one? It wasn't DigiNotar. It must have been something since DigiNotar. That was like a decade ago. Anyway, let's move on. The Snowflake situation. This has been probably for the last month, maybe 6 weeks, just a massive story because it has left a huge trail of destruction behind it. Now, I made some comments to Matthew Schwartz yesterday, who did a story on this, which I have linked to in the tweet thread. So let me go there because he's got some figures and some stats. Breaches due to credential stuffing, who's accountable? So just as a brief recap, let's go to Snowflake. Snowflake DB, the correct, is it snowflake.com? It is snowflake.com. What do they do? Generative AI is easier in the AI data cloud. Best of Snowflake Summit 24, Snowflake so far, effortlessly customize your AI applications, the best LLM for enterprise AI. No mention on the homepage about problems. A lot of busy marketing teams lately, aren't there? So it's cloud storage and it is used rather extensively by different organizations to store very large amounts of data. They have been in the news over this last 4 to 6 weeks, because threat actors, I just hate that term, people on the internet, hackers, have been finding ways of accessing other parties' Snowflake accounts. Now, a lot of this appears to boil down to engineering from corporate victims the credentials to accounts that then get attackers into the aforementioned Snowflake accounts. Now, as Matthew says here, the short version of how this attack unfolded can be told in two words: credential stuffing. This refers to taking usernames, often email addresses and password pairs from public or private data leaks, and trying them across a range of other sites to see where they might work. Comes back to this week's sponsor again, and identity attacks. In a joint report about the data breaches, Mandiant and CrowdStrike, which were hired to assist with incident response, said that attackers built a tool classily named RapeFlake, now tracked by Google's Mandiant as Frostbite, you can see why they renamed it, to automate the process. Multiple accounts of Snowflake's customers were breached, and some victims received ransom demands for the stolen data. Investigators say about 165 organizations have been affected. While most haven't been publicly named, known victims include Santander Bank, that's one of the first ones that came out, Advanced Auto Parts, went into Have I Been Pwned, and that's Advance, sorry, I keep saying Advanced. Advance Auto Parts, went into Have I Been Pwned away, Los Angeles School District, and luxury retailer Neiman Marcus, who we're going to talk about later on. Another victim, Live Nation Entertainment's Ticketmaster, in its latest data breach notification, so the breach of Snowflake began on April 2 and was discovered on May 23. Now, of course, Ticketmaster looks like it's going to be one of the biggest in terms of volumes. The numbers that we've seen there are about 560 million. Now, here's the thing. Is it 560 million accounts, 560 million people, 560 million email addresses? There's always some contention around those three numbers. And certainly when we see headline figures, and I'll talk about some of those in the next two breaches, the numbers that we see posted to the likes of data breach trading forums and not necessarily representative of the unique impacted people. There's a nuance here we'll come back to. So, credential stuffing, obtaining access to other people's accounts. The interesting thing here, and this is sort of what Matthew's piece is about in terms of accountability, is who is accountable for this? Is it Snowflake? Is it the organization who's had their accounts taken over due to credential stuffing or otherwise obtaining account details? And the answer I gave Matthew when he asked who's accountable is I said, look, it's a shared responsibility. And time again, we come back to this, where clearly we need individuals to not reuse credentials, to not get phished, to do all sorts of things that they do have some control over. But equally, this is bad press for Snowflake. It's not good when your customers have their data taken from your platform and you're in the news as having had data breaches. So we can't take this technically absolute position that nothing went wrong with Snowflake. And time again, the statements that we've heard from them is that there was no breach of the Snowflake platform, Snowflake is secure, so on and so forth. But you're there in the headlines nonstop. This is a really, really bad look. And the shared responsibility part of it is that they need to have resilience against the fact that there could be legitimate credentials coming from an illegitimate party. And this is why we have things like multi-factor authentication and user behavioral analytics and anti-automation and all of the other bits and pieces which are meant to stop account takeovers like this. Come back to that, looking at the comments here. Stefan says, also insurance and seals of security. Oh, let's not go down the rabbit hole. I think, have they disappeared? Gotten less? Jake, I note your tweet about the proactive notification from Ticketek that you received. I never got any notification directly from them, despite getting the HIBP notification yesterday. We'll come back to that in the next section. Finishing up on the Snowflake piece, they've clearly got a big role to play in stopping this sort of behavior. And as much as they might be on the sort of front foot going, it's not a compromise of us, it's behavior by our customers, I bet you there's work going on in the background to try and stop this stuff from happening again in the future. I wonder, because it's early days, I wonder as the course of time progresses what reaction we are going to see from impacted organizations towards Snowflake. Will they be held accountable, or at least attempted to be held accountable, for the outcome of some of these data breaches? Because some of them are extraordinarily large. I mean, we just mentioned Ticketmaster. That is a huge number. Half a billion anything is a huge number in data breach terms. But that's, yeah, that is an interesting one. Snowflake has promised to give customers additional MFA and other options. We're developing a plan to require our customers to implement advanced security controls like multi-factor authentication or network policies. You sort of wonder why they didn't mandate that, don't you, in the first place? Ideally, the company will also start to support the gold standard of phishing-resistant MSA that CISA advocates. Well, I'm in two minds about that, because I've said many times before, it's a hard ask to mandate multi-factor authentication on public services. For argument's sake, if Facebook said, the only way you're going to be able to log into Facebook is you must have a second factor, even if it's just SMS, let alone secure token, YubiKey, so on and so forth. It's a hard ask because you've got, in their case, billions of mums and dads and normal normies consumers using the service. I do think it's a different situation when you're a cloud provider. I know Amazon recently has said, look, we just mandate it 2FA across everything. When you're a cloud provider and your customers are technical parties, surely you're not going to lose customers, good customers, by saying, look, we've heard all of these wonderful features and good pricing and high availability and redundancy and everything, and we just require you to have multi-factor. Is someone going to look at all that and go, well, I was in until I saw the fact that I have to create a token, and now I'm out? That doesn't, it just feels like it should be mandatory and on by default for everyone. Okay. So talking about two incidents specific to Snowflake, Ticketek. Now, Ticketek is not Ticketmaster, so this is one of the first things to clarify. When we started seeing news of the Snowflake incident, I think Ticketmaster was really the first one that got a lot of press. And I got a huge amount of media inquiries about this, and I'd have film crews in here, and I'd be in studios and things with people wanting to talk, you know, normal journalist, everyday consumer-centric media, about Ticketmaster. And time again, a journalist would mess it up and say Ticketek. Now, if you're not from Australia, as far as I know, Ticketek is just an Australian company. Ticketmaster is worldwide. A lot of the tickets we buy for events here in Australia are from Ticketek. And journalists would keep conflating this. And then I'd have to say, hang on a moment, you mean Ticketmaster, right? And they go, yeah, sorry, I'm messing up. And then just to make everything super, super confusing, Ticketek got breached. So suddenly there's a disclosure from them. And we had our cyber coordinator here in Australia. We have a dedicated government role for coordinating these cyber things because we've had so many of them lately, was tweeting about the fact that Ticketek had suffered a breach as well, which we now know is related to Snowflake. So now you've got Ticketmaster and Ticketek, two different companies, same cloud platform, similar breaches. Now, yesterday I put Ticketmaster, I've done it myself. Yesterday I put Ticketek data in Have I Been Pwned and sent out notifications. I've got a tweet thread about this. So let's just check what I said here on the timeline. Now, the first thing is, I'm in there. I'm breached again. How many am I up to? Jeez. It's 30-something. I know that. And this, incidentally, is on my my old email address, which I no longer tend to use. 31. Wow. Holy crap, what have I been doing this whole time? Using the internet. This is, if you're on the internet for long enough, you get lots of accounts and you end up invariably in lots of data breaches. So anyway, my data is in there. And the party that sent me the data opened the conversation with, hey, here's your data. And it's to be honest, it's relatively benign data in the scheme of different data breaches we have. So my name is there, my email address is there, and my date of birth is there. There is no address, there's no phone number, there is a hashed password. Like that's it. So it's not Ashley Madison or Medibank or any of these sorts of things, but it's still my data. And I think we all have a moment when we see our data in a breach, or we get a notification, whether it be from Have I Been Pwned of the organization, and we're just like, crap, not again. So anyway, party popped up, said, here's your data. Ticketek, per my thread here, had put out a very early notification. So I actually got a disclosure notice from them. What date was mine? I think from memory, they put out a public statement on the 31st of May, and then I got an email very shortly after to say, hey, look, you've been in the data breach. So that was great. So it looks like disclosure happened very early. Oh, here it is in the thread. Where are we? 1st of June, I got mine. So they go through and they've seen your data, its usual sort of disclosure message here. The only thing that's been at all unusual about this incident is the comment that, was it Marek? Jack. Comment that Jack made here is that a few people have said, I didn't get a notification. And it would seem that what's happened is, for reasons that are still not clear, there is a gap between the people who are notified and the total number of people in the breach corpus. So I'm not sure how big that gap is, because we didn't see a statement in the original disclosure about how many people were impacted by the breach. I found 17.6 million unique email addresses. 72% of those were already in Have I Been Pwned, including me. So clearly there's a bit of a gap for them to fill. So I think at this point, the hope is that they figure out what that gap is, they notify the impacted individuals, and then people like Jack will get a notification email as well. Comment from Marek, kind of similar to how AWS S3 buckets became secure private by default after too many were accidentally left open to the public due to misconfiguration. So there was a period there, I feel, around 2018, where there were so many instances of MongoDB, and I think before that it might have been the S3 buckets as well. And there were people just crawling through Shodan, finding open things, and then going and having a look and taking the data out. Now, I think it's a little bit different here, because it seems that the Snowflake counts were protected by authenticated requests, for want of a better term, and it's simply that the attacker has been able to get the material required to authenticate. I'm using the word material because I'm just not sure that it's all pure credential stuffing. If anyone knows the exact details, I haven't done a deep dive into Snowflake yet. Is it literally the username and password used by an administrator, and then someone has gone to the Snowflake dashboard, logged in with those credentials, and then pulled out the key or whatever other material it is they need to download the data? Or are they exposed Snowflake keys somewhere and someone's gone and pulled those? The fact that Matthew said credential stuffing seems to suggest the former rather than the latter. Okay, so that's the ticker tape piece. The next one, which is still unfolding, which is starting to get quite a bit of momentum and is significantly larger in volume, is Neiman Marcus. Now, if you're not from America like me, Neiman Marcus, and correct me if I'm wrong here, American friends, Neiman Marcus is a retail store. I believe it's a department store with a lot of chains. I believe they have multiple other partner brands as well. Certainly, that's what the data is suggesting at the moment. And Neiman Marcus has appeared on a popular hacking forum, which is the term the term we use. Someone mentioned, when I was awake at 1 a.m. this morning because jet lag, I was reading my tweets, someone mentioned that the forum it's posted to keeps getting resurrected. It gets taken down by law enforcement, then it gets replaced by something else or recovered. And I said, yeah, it's the cockroach of data breach trading forums. It just never dies. It keeps coming back. Anyway, Neiman Marcus. I've put this in my tweets here somewhere. That appeared with data for sale, I want to say a few weeks ago. Yesterday morning, someone has dumped a whole bunch of that data with 40 million Neiman Marcus accounts. Now, a little bit like the ticker tech one, just to scroll back to them for a second, the breach posting for that had said 30 million, I think they said 30 million rows or something to that effect. I found 17.6 million unique email addresses. There is probably some redundancy of individuals having multiple email addresses as well. So there is a subset of that, which would be the actual impacted individuals. So when we see Neiman Marcus say 40 million here, or the poster of the data say 40 million, it's not entirely clear how many people that actually is. And very often as well, we see posts that talk about rows. That was the case with Ticketek, 30 million. There were 30 million rows, but some people bought multiple tickets. Did it work that way? Or was it that some people had, I don't know, either. I bought a ticket to go and watch the race, the GC500, and that's why I'm in there. So Neiman Marcus, there's a very large amount of data here. Now, what's been posted is a subset of a larger amount of data that was referred to in one of the earlier posts for sale. It's just a massive list. Let me open this image and try and even re... I'm not going to go through all the columns because it literally looks like 100 plus columns. But everything from card-related data, which incidentally seems to be partial card data. Now, there's a little bit of discussion going on in the background around how much of that data they should have kept, so there might be some questions to answer there. But it's like all the usual stuff that you'd have from buying things online, your name, there's physical addresses in there, dates of birth, genders, obviously orders, transactions. It's just a massive, massive list, excuse me, of other data attributes, phone numbers. Looking at the description here in this for sale, they say 40 million emails, 5.8 million rows, 85 million rows, gift card 12 million rows, and there's a download link. So this is now in very broad circulation, and there's a bit of a problem being created for Neiman Marcus here. They made a submission to their local regulator in the state of Maine. Someone said to me the other day it was a bit odd because they weren't based in Maine. Anyway, made a submission and said 64,000 people impacted. And I think from when I looked at that submission to the regulator, it was something like 100 people from Maine. Now, you might be thinking 64,000 is a long way from 40 million, which is true. It's a very, very long way. And I think the problem they're going to have here, and having already had a look at the data, which is now very broadly in circulation, is that there's no way in the world at 64,000. It is a very, very large number. It will be a tens of millions number. So how are they going to reconcile the gap between the submission that they've made to their local regulator and the data which is actually circulating? I've been chatting to a couple of journalists, because journalists always reach out and they've got questions about these things, you know. How many people are impacted? What's the type of data? So on and so forth. And it seems that everyone's having a bit of trouble getting a comment from Neiman Marcus at the moment. But the problem is, as I've often said before, that the truth is in the data, and the data is out there, and the data is circulating, and you've got all sorts of people tearing it apart and taking a look at how it works. So they're going to need to come out with something on this, because otherwise we're going to see a lot of commentary from the likes of the media on this. Now, in terms of where that sits with have I been pwned, I'm jet lagged. This is something I'll pick up in the new week. Because this has happened quite some time ago and there's so much ambiguity around it, conflicting statements that are already in the public domain, I'd like to see some clarity over exactly how many people are impacted by this. And I'd like to see some statements from Neiman Marcus on the total scope. I know they're being pushed on that pretty hard at the moment. Hopefully we get something on that, and then I can get that data in maybe early next week. Related to this, and also in my tweet timeline, something for some reason, just over the last, what was this dated? This was like 18 hours ago. We are now suddenly seeing a spate of these Snowflake-related breaches dumped publicly. So I've got a tweet here from HackManic that's Hack with a 4 instead of an A. And HackManic has shared 4 different screen caps here of data that started to be dumped publicly. Twilio, Authy, 33 million phones. Now, I haven't seen anything from Twilio on this. Our friends at Twilio have been a previous sponsor. Thank you, Twilio. So I haven't seen anything from them. I've got no idea whether this one is legitimate or not. However, it is from the same threat actor that is responsible for some of these other breaches, which we do know are what they're alleged to be. So Twilio Authy, 33 million phones. Neiman Marcus, we've just spoken about. There's 40 million records in there, so that has leaked as well. Truist Bank has also leaked. All of these ones are from a party called Shiny Hunters. Of much repute, been in the press a lot because of their work there. And Neiman Marcus also posted here by Spider. Spider has listed this data around, and this actually goes back, this is Tuesday here as well. So I think this was when they were trying to sell the data. Price for sale of data, $150,000 USD. I also wonder with each of these, we've often seen parties who obtain this data and later sell it, somewhere in the midst there, try to shake the companies down for money. Now, I don't know for any of these if that's what's happened, if there's been a ransom demand as well. But I wouldn't be surprised if that was also on the cards. So between Spider and Shiny Hunter here, there seems to be a lot of obtaining of Snowflake data, putting it up for sale, and then dumping it. Now, that's going to lead me pretty cleanly into the blog post I wrote on the plane on that 36-hour journey on Monday, the state of data breaches, because all this has got me thinking a lot. And it's a bit of a strange time. I'll get to that blog post in a second. Daily Dysfunction. Is there any truth to the Twilio posting by the same bad actor? I don't know. I don't know. I haven't looked at the data. I haven't seen a statement from Twilio. It's not early here, but I only got up very recently. So if anyone's seen a statement from Twilio, drop a comment in there and we can go and check it out together. Let's have a look at this blog post. So when you do anything enough, you see patterns. But have I been pwned? We're now at 780 data breaches that are in Have I Been Pwned. There are probably that many data breaches again that I have looked at and not loaded for one reason or another. So let's say I've done this 1,500 times and you see patterns, and you see some patterns change over the course of time as well. And as I was traveling earlier this week, the same sort of things just kept coming to mind, the same patterns and behaviors I kept seeing. And I want to run you through these because this blog post got a lot of good feedback, where I think a lot of this resonated with people. And it wasn't to sort of make it a poor me kind of thing to elicit sympathy. But I was trying to explain how painfully hard it is, I guess, playing this role and seeing the different behaviors from various organizations. Now, I'll just run you through the headlines and explain what I was thinking here. So first of all, breach disclosure is still a painful time suck. Now, that's a pretty self-explanatory headline. Trying to find the right contact at an organization to disclose an incident, trying to get timely response from people in an organization is very, very hard. Timely is enormously important because things happen very quickly, minute by minute, in data breaches, particularly when data starts spreading and circulating. Now, generally, if something hasn't been in the press at all, or there hasn't been a statement from the company, I try and get in touch because for all I know, they don't know about it. But how do you get in touch? Like, do you go to the contacts page and then there's sales and marketing? You know, like, who do you talk to? Do you fill out the contact us form? Yeah, I often try all of those. I often go to LinkedIn, try and find people on LinkedIn who are in, say, a C-suite position for the organization. That doesn't necessarily get you a timely response either. Look for a security.txt. Now, this is meant to be the solution to these problems. Having a security.txt is meant to detail who do you get in touch with security-related problems. The problem is it never exists on websites that have been breached because they never use them. Except for one time. And I made a point in this blog post. I said, look, I'm not going to talk about any specific incidents because I do want to keep this pretty high level without throwing any individual organization under the bus. But there was one recently where I ended up going to Twitter and going, hey, does anyone have a security contact at? And someone's like, you know, they've got a security.txt. I'm like, holy shit, really? Wow. At last, there's one. Normally, it is extraordinarily hard to get in touch with organizations. And the problem is that when they do have a security.txt, like I have on all of my things, then you've got to deal with all the big bounties. So I'm sympathetic to the organization as well, because when they do put information out there to be contacted about data breaches, they get rubbish. I've had one this week where someone's like, hi, do you have bug bounty? And I literally applied to them and said, bug bounty or big bounty? And they're a little bit dismissive, and then I didn't hear any more from them. I know what it's going to be. Like, no one leads with a question like that and has a genuine bug. Anyway, so the disclosure is really hard, and it's hard on the organizational side as well to separate the noise from the signal. So I'm sympathetic to organizations that do take a little bit of time to process this. And very often I've heard from organizations say, we did have someone reach out to us about security vulnerability. We thought it was junk and we filed it away. Hard problem. Incidentally, and I haven't spoken about this for a long time, but this is why I really like the likes of BugCrowd, where you can go through and triage all of your bugs and reports and things through a dedicated organization that can filter this stuff out and unburden yourself. No financial interest, but Casey Ellis is a mate and a good old Aussie startup, BugCrowd. Okay, so I'll just read what I wrote. Once I do manage to make contact, I'd say about half the time the organization is good to deal with. They often already know of HIBP and are already using it for themselves for domain searches. That does help. When you're talking to an organization, they're like, yeah, we use your service. We never wanted to hear from you, but thank you for the service. And this is exactly what I said. We've joked before, the company and I, that they're grateful for the service, but never wanted to hear from me. The other half of the time, the response borders on open hostility. In one case that comes to mind, I got an email from their lawyer after finally tracking down a SweSeek tech exec in LinkedIn and sending them a message. It wasn't threatening, but I had to go through a series of to and fro explaining what HIBP was, why I had their data, and how the process usually unfolded. Now, this was some time ago, and it was obviously a law firm that had no idea what HIBP Pwn was. And I just remember the lawyer sending me questions about, why do you have this data? Like, you know, what are you doing with this? I run a data breach notification service. The FBI also sends me data, and I think that helped. I think once they started Googling around, they're like, oh, okay, all right, I understand now, you're not the bad guy. All right, before I go on the next section, Merrick, speaking of patterns, have you ever considered machine learning to help process the data breaches? Do you think it would even be possible to leverage it? I don't need machine learning to regex out email addresses. How's that? Now, could machine learning discern other interesting things about data breaches? Yeah, absolutely. I think we could get some really, really interesting insights. I do wonder the feasibility, legality, ethics of doing that, running machine learning over someone else's massive data set. Imagine running it over Ashley Madison. What could machine learning tell you about Ashley Madison? That's a very, very dicey area to go down. Maybe someone else can do that and let me know how it goes. Next one, breach notifications are still not what we thought they would be. This is painful because there is a mismatch between the expectation of most people who are in data breaches and the behavior of many organizations. Now, I'll give you a good example of what I mean by this. And again, I'm speaking in general terms, but I've seen it many times. There is an expectation from individuals that when they're in a data breach, they will be notified promptly by the organization, regardless of what's in there. If it's just your email address, it's like, well, you leaked my email address, you should let me know. And I think that's a very reasonable expectation. Many organizations will not notify individuals, deliberately not notify individuals. And you then hear people say, yes, but GDPR or CCPA or whatever your acronym of regulator is in whatever your part of the world says you have to. They don't. You don't have to notify under every circumstance. And I'll give you a good example from our own notifiable data breach scheme here in Australia. There are criteria that need to be met in order to report to the regulator and then in order to need to notify individuals. And some of those criteria include things like, is the data breach likely to cause serious harm to the individual? That is self-assessable. You could easily make an argument as a breached organization that the example I often use is you're running Cat Forum. You're running Cat Forum, let's say it's .com.au, and you have email addresses and passwords for people to talk about cats. Now you could say, well, it's cats. Who cares? Maybe a dog person. It's cats. It's just a discussion forum. It's not likely to cause serious harm if someone gets into your discussion about the cats. However, you know that those email addresses and passwords have been used on social media and email accounts and banks and whatever else. So I really, really dislike the party who is responsible for the disclosure and who is trying to protect their own interests being able to make the determination of whether they notify. And I can think of many incidents in the past where even very big organizations, even right in the heart of GDPR land in Europe, have chosen not to notify individuals. The data is circulated. I've told people via Have I Been Pwned, and you get a whole bunch of people turn around and go, "What the, like, why have you not notified us?" And I can also think of many instances where, as a result of that, it has caused the organization to disclose to those people, which is a good outcome, but that shouldn't be the way we get there. The timeliness as well. There's a, I have this mental model, and maybe someone who's more, I don't know, like scientific or mathematical than me can one day help me turn this into something that looks really, really cool. But the value of data over time diminishes very quickly. Now, what I mean by this is when the data is first obtained in a data breach, it is a very high value because usually at that 0 hour, the organization themselves don't know about it. The individuals certainly don't know about it. You've got hacker over here with a handful of stolen credentials and personal information, whatever else, and no one knows. They can start doing account takeover attacks. They can start attempting credential stuffing on other services with those credentials because no one's changed their passwords yet. It's really, really valuable. That 0 hour is hugely important to them. And then over the course of time, multiple things happen. People organically change their passwords. Anomalous behavior is detected by either the platform that they've breached or the other platforms they're trying to now do account takeover attacks on. Accounts get reset. Things get locked. Eventually, press comes out about it. And the value diminishes as time goes by. Now, what that means is, conversely, the most important time to let people know about a data breach is as soon as possible so that they can do things to protect themselves. And it feels like a profoundly simple concept to explain that way. Yet time and time again, there is a massive lead time between breach and notification. Now, this is why I was very complimentary Ticker Tech early on, because there was a very short time between when they learned of the breach and I sent the notification. Good job. Neiman Marcus, no one has received breach notifications yet. And we know that that breach has been in public discussion for many, many, many days, if not weeks. I'm trying to think of when we first learned about it. We know it was 24 hours ago that data was dumped publicly as well. Still haven't heard anything. It can be a hard problem too. Like, I'm not just chucking the organization under the bus here. But let's say it's Neiman Marcus and they suddenly need to email, I don't know what their total customer base is. Let's say it's 100 million for the sake of simplicity. How easy is it to send 100 million emails on the drop of a hat if you haven't prepared for it? It's not your normal marketing email, which of course many people opt out of, and maybe that's not something Neiman Marcus sent. I don't know. But as time goes by and all of these people have their data out there, they're having their accounts taken over. I don't think actually there's passwords in Neiman Marcus, so let's not focus on that too much. But people who are in breaches where there are credentials, have accounts taken over, where there's other, especially when there's extensive personally identifiable information, addresses, phone numbers, other behavioral things, they're at risk of identity takeovers and other things like that. Like, extending that period is just so detrimental to the individuals. I'm passionate about that. Eddie Gerge says, Troy, when you reach out to random corporations who have breaches or issues, what email address do you attempt to contact? Just curious what address I should monitor create. Security.txt. And I should actually look for it, because now that I've actually seen a website with one, you can make it whatever you want to do. Many companies use security app. So long as it's in security.txt, it's documented and it's discoverable. But then you've got to monitor that, and then you've got to deal with all the big bounties that will come to it. Oh, there you go. That's exactly what Stefan said. Well done, mate. I knew you were on the same wavelength. Eddie says, I've already read some pretty disadvantaged things about those, especially scrapers tell you about all sorts of garbage and then writing about, well, I mean, this is exactly the big bounty. Now, if you're not familiar with the term, Eddie, big bounty, just Google Troy Hunt big bounty. I didn't create the term, but I did write a blog post about it. This is the problem. It's not just reporting security vulnerabilities as well. I have my email address on my contact page because I want people to be able to email me about anything from press inquiries to speaking engagements to I have a data breach. And as a result of that, I get a bunch of spam. I mean, once you make yourself contactable, you have to deal with a lot of junk as well. And the trick is to filter that out. So that was the headline. Breach notifications are still not what they thought they would be. What else is in here? The Form 8K SEC filings in the US are interesting. So there's been recent legislation that requires some organizations to file Form 8K SEC filings. And my understanding is because there could be a material impact for publicly listed companies in the wake of a data breach, so they have to make a filing. And what's interesting now is that we're seeing cases where these filings are being made. So there is now something in the public domain, but not disclosures sent to individuals. So it's kind of curious the way that's like back-channeled a little bit, but then we're like, oh, hey, these guys have been breached. I wonder where the notifications are. Next headline here is companies prioritize downplaying severity and covering their asses. Again, it's self-explanatory. I've got a quote here. I had a breach some years ago that was sent to me. And without giving any detail away, a very close friend of mine, one of my closest friends, was working for the company at the time in the room with the people having the discussions. And we'd gone like more than a week and nothing had come out. No disclosure, no public statement. Remember what I just said about how important it is to do early disclosure in order to protect the individuals. And we're talking and I'm like, what is going on? What are you guys doing? And to quote him here, and this is the quote from my recollection, he said, mate, it's a room full of lawyers working out how to spin this. And inevitably, you're going to have lawyers involved in situations like this, particularly where there has been a combination of criminal activity plus all sorts of other implications for the organization. And as I think I said somewhere in here, I'm sort of sympathetic to the extent that the organization's responsibility is to the shareholders and protecting the organization's brand, but that often comes at the detriment of the customers. But that is where the accountability lies. The board reports to the shareholders. This is the way it works. So inevitably, there's a degree of damage control. But I don't think they're mutually exclusive either. I really don't think that an organization trying to minimize reputational damage needs to simultaneously do so by putting the customers at greater risk. And we do have lots of good previous examples of organizations, I think, doing a good job of both. The Australian Red Cross Blood Service, 2016, someone sent me, what was it, about 650,000 records that they'd found publicly exposed. Someone who is not what I'd classify a hacker, someone who was a white hat, to use the term, sent this data to me. Within 72 hours, they'd tracked down the source of the incident. The CEO had been out there in the news doing press releases. They had sent disclosure notices via email, disclosure notices via SMS. It was beautifully handled. Afterwards, I wrote a blog post about Disclosure 101, how to succeed after you've failed. Because in my mind, that was a failure. In fact, it was a partner or a supplier of the Australian Red Cross Blood Service that had left production data in an open test environment. So it was sort of an external dependency to make it even worse. But to my mind, they owned it and they acted so quickly. And surely that was in the best interest of both the shareholders and the customers. And I'd really like to see more of that. I don't want to become like a PR person, but I feel like there is a career out there somewhere where I could just go into these organizations who've had these breaches and go, okay, let's try and keep everybody happy. Can we keep the lawyers happy? Can we keep the shareholders happy? Can we keep the customers happy? Can we just minimize the damage on everyone? I don't know. That's a pipe dream. Still in the security tech, see here, Marek says, there's also the risk of a bad actor defrauding exposed customers by impersonating the breached entity. I've got to think about that more carefully. The risk of bad actors defrauding exposed customers by impersonating. Okay, so we're talking about hackers contacting customers and pretending to be the company that was breached. Marek's followed up. The recent action by AIC against Medibank highlights the legal risks using the information obtained in the data breach. I think there's an interesting discussion around the cascading effect of a data breach. So let's say it's the Neiman Marcus stuff that's floating around at the moment. Now that that is on that popular hacking forum, I liken to a cockroach. And I mean that because of the fact that you can't kill a cockroach. I mean, they're meant to survive nuclear holocaust. You know, they keep... Anyway, as floating around there, there are many parties in that circle who do not have the community's best interests at heart. Let's just put it that way. Now, if they have access to, let's just take the headline at face value, 40 million email addresses, 40 million Neiman Marcus customers, and in there they've got a home address and a phone number and previous purchases and things like that. What's to stop them from now going through and targeting those individuals? And we have seen this many times before. We've seen this with Ashley Madison. So individuals in that data breach for years and years, even as recently as last year, remember this was a 2015 incident. So going on 8 years later, getting extortion emails. They're not personal, they're mass mails, right? It's like some rando sitting on their computer, probably on the other side of the world, well and truly out of our normal jurisdictions, just mail merging to everyone for cents in the dollar, or yeah, basically nothing, going, hey, you've been in here. If you don't want all of your friends to know that you were looking to have an affair, please send me Bitcoin now. Vastaamo, the Finnish psychotherapy service that was breached a few years ago, they got ransomed, they didn't pay, so the attacker, who's now in jail, thank you, I didn't do anything. When I say thank you, I mean that is good for the community. The attacker then went through and ransomed the individual and said, if you don't give me money, I will leak your psychotherapy notes. I mean, this is, it's just astoundingly evil, isn't it? Like to take vulnerable people at their worst times and say, give me money or I will leak your secrets to the internet. And he did. He did put it all on the internet. So we're seeing a pipeline of individuals there who are then directly targeted after some of these data breaches. Now, of course, we also don't know how many of these data breaches go into someone's great big personal stash, which I've written about before, and become part of a massive data warehouse to enrich information that can then be targeted for nefarious purposes. If you take all of the breaches we've seen go public this year, take that information, aggregate it all together, you've now got probably billions of people with a fairly extensive set of attributes that you can go and start to target your evil things to. I don't know if that's exactly what you meant, Marek, or what you meant, but yeah. James, brand new Ashley Madison series on Netflix. Yes, and it's good. It's much better than the one that I was in on Hulu. I'll tell you a funny story about that, and then we'll come back to this. As I said, Ashley Madison was 2015. A couple of years ago, a couple of different media organizations started to reach out saying, hey, we're going to do a documentary on Ashley Madison. And yeah, we'd like you to be involved because you had a lot to do with it at the time with Have I Been Pwned, and then particularly all the feedback people gave me telling me about the problems that they were having and somehow expecting me to have relationship answers. Anyway, I ended up doing a big blog post with FAQs. But I also did a blog post later on about here's what Ashley Madison members had told me. And it was a bunch of really, really personal, sensitive stuff. So anyway, a couple of different media organizations. And I said the same thing I say to any media org that reaches out. I say, yeah, sure, I'll have a chat. No worries. And then we did some filming with one of them. I was in Norway. I have a feeling this was January last year. Did some filming with one of them. It went on to Hulu. I think it's available if you're in Australia through Stan or I don't know. I can't remember. So anyway, I did a bunch of filming with that. Like most media, a bunch of filming boils down to like 30 seconds of video. We watched that series, I want to say like 6 months ago or something, and we're like, eh. Meanwhile, the other one, which I'd also been talking to, once they saw that, went, we just want all new people. So what? Like, do you want the people that were involved at the coalface of this, or do you want talking heads? And as much as I like the Netflix one, there's one or two people in there, and I think you've probably seen this, James. You know, you might know who I mean. Where you're just like, why are you here? You're like a social media commentator or PR. What? Anyway, I actually thought that was a really good piece, and the fact that they had insiders from Ashley Madison there was really good. Go and watch it. I'm not in there, but it's better. Not because of that, but it's just a better one on Netflix. Where were we? Next topic here. Data breach victims are making it worse. Now, this was around class actions and the actions that individuals take against organizations. Now, we just established that I'm in 31 data breaches for my old email address. 31 data breaches that are in Have I Been Pwned. More than that, in terms of other breaches I know about but didn't go into Have I Been Pwned. More than that, again, from the other breaches that I've never even heard about. And maybe the organization never heard about them either. So, at least 31 data breaches. And every time it is email address, password, often it's phone number, maybe it's physical address, date of birth, stuff like this. I don't like that data being out there, but it is very much a repetitive process of the same stuff, cycling over and over and over again. And what I've seen over probably more recent years is this emergence of class actions by individuals in data breaches against organizations. Now, I've written a dedicated blog post about this, had a bit of Better Call Saul. It's a hero image there. And I've explained how I'm often getting contacted by class action lawyers. In fact, what they'd really like, class action lawyers really want product placement on Have I Been Pwned. And I had one recently. There seemed to be a lot in Germany for some reason. So I had one recently from Germany say, look, if someone does a search and they're in this particular breach, can we get an ad for our law firm there saying, you know, go and get money now? Now, I explained that I was not supportive of that position. There's a few good reasons why. First of all, to my mind at least, I'm not a lawyer, but to my mind at least, in order to require some form of compensation for some event that has happened, surely there must be some sort of damage to you in order to justify the return. So let's say it's the LinkedIn data breach. Happened in 2012. Circulated 2016. I was in there. Now, my email address and my BIC, I think it was my, no, it was SHA-1, wasn't it? Salted SHA-1 hashed password, which of course was password manager generated, so no one's cracking that. They were both leaked. What happened to me after that? Well, my email address was out there. That's kind of it. Maybe I got more spam. Maybe I got targeted phishing attacks related to LinkedIn. I get targeted phishing attacks every day. Geez, go and have a look at your junk mail. It's crazy. Should LinkedIn pay me money for that? And I vehemently believe, no, there is no damage to me. I have not suffered because of this. And someone made the point recently. I said, what about, say, the Optus data breach in Australia where people had to go and change their driver's licenses? Well, I mean, Optus is an interesting example because I think it was a total of 10,200 records that were posted to the Cockroach Hacking Forum. And there was a larger corpus of data, about 10 million, which this person didn't post publicly, but still breached, still in unauthorized hands. So you had queues and queues of people going and changing their driver's licenses. Now, you could argue that someone had to spend time to do that. But to the best of my knowledge, no one has been able to demonstrate that that Optus data breach led to harm, identity takeover, money drawn from a bank account, any of these sorts of things. It was inconvenient, it was annoying, but if that's the extent of it, then what is that worth? You have to replace your driver's license every 5 years here anyway. If you're at year four, do you claim 20% of the value of your time while you're, you know what I'm saying? I think it's a very odd thing to say that this data breach in particular has caused me harm to the extent that I need a lawyer to get compensation for it. The bit that worries me with this is that, as I said in the original blog post about class actions, it's very clear who makes the money from this. It is the class action lawyers. It's very clear who makes effectively no money from this, and it is the plaintiffs, the individuals who join this class action. And we have so many precedents of the money they get being, for example, in the tens of dollars. Now, how much time do you have to invest on joining a class action before it's not worth $70? An hour? 5 hours? 10 hours? Like, what's the value of your time? It's also very clear who suffers the most from this. And it's the organizations who are the corporate victims because they're having to fight these frivolous lawsuits. Now, of course, then they have cyber insurance, which they have to pay premiums for, which is an overhead for them, which drives up their cost, and then we all pay more for whatever product it is they make. It just feels like such a shitty, sleazy business model that then drives adverse behavior? Is it any wonder that organizations don't want to disclose data breaches when they see slews of class actions happening after other people get breached? Is it any wonder that there are rooms full of lawyers delaying notifications for individuals when they have to be so cautious about how they spin a data breach because stuff like this is going to happen afterwards, and everything that they say publicly is then going to be taken and possibly used in that class action? I guess it's the way it is, but it just boggles my mind as to how counterproductive it is. Going back to the comments here. James, I was wondering if you could put a form in security.txt instead of an email. It could reduce spam, possibly. I know what you're saying. I think that the issue I have with this is that you're effectively saying, how can we make it harder to get in touch with the email address? When, like, the whole point of the security.txt is to make it easier to get in touch with the organization. I don't know if anyone remembers this. It must be like 20 years ago or something. And I can't remember if it was Microsoft or some other industry body was saying, we should make every email cost like 1 cent. You cannot send an email without paying a cent, because that would really, really cut down on the likes of spam. Should we revisit that? I don't know. Then the rich can send spam and the poor can't. So that's not great either. Marek, I read your comment already. Netflix, not seen it. Eddie is only in 26 breaches. You've got to get out them already. now, my 26 breaches is just my old email address. My new email address is now in multiple breaches as well. So good on me. Stefan says, just blame Scott for the Optus breach. Where's Scott? What am I missing? I'm still too tired. Simon, what are your thoughts about education around online security? Yeah, great. As someone who's made, 50 Pluralsight courses? Go and watch all the courses over and over and over again. Look, I think to be objective about it, education is an extremely important part of security, whether you're a software developer and talking security or whether you are end users. We also need to work on the assumption that we can't rely on the humans to do everything right. When we talk about things like phishing attacks, we can't just say, look, you idiot, you filled in your details on a phishing page. You should have known better. And we do have good technical controls. Well, we do have technical controls. We've got things like Google Safe Browsing, which I find now, just for kicks, when I get one of those phishing emails, I tend to get a lot of phishing SMSs at about 2 a.m. about a package that can't be delivered. And I have a look at the URL, and so long as there's nothing unique that identifies me, I'll tap it just for fun. And so many times you get the big red Chrome screen. That's great. Technical controls to complement the human controls, which is as a result of us having educated people about online security. So I think that education is a major part. I'd love to see more of it. Again, looking at the two groups, the technical folks building systems, I'd love to see more of it as part of our formal education of software developers. And then thinking about the end users, I'd love to see more of it, particularly starting in schools. When I look at what my kids, who are 11 and 14, are learning from school, I'm not saying much. Honestly, not. I suspect my kids are probably teaching the teachers about online security. I see the schools have cyber safety sessions where parents can go along and learn about cyber safety. And I see the content that's in there, and it looks good. I've never gone along to one of them. I think that might be fun sometime. How much of it really sticks? Put it this way. We know empirically that a single-digit percentage of people use password managers, which means 90% of people reuse their passwords everywhere, still today. And that's one of the most basic education things that we have over and over again, but here we are. So education good, but complemented with technical controls as well. That helps people fall into the pit of success. James says the Sony class action over other OS would have been worth days of my time because I was pissed at them. Yeah, but I think you've nailed it there, James, because what I'm reading here is that you joined that class action because you wanted to punish the company. And part of my issue with class actions is more that the bigger question of who is responsible for punitive measures against a company that suffered a data breach? And I believe the answer to that is the regulator, is the government. And of course, governments around the world, depending on where you are, do have controls to do that. And they are controls that are getting better and better over the course of time. It's slow, but they're getting better. That's what we'd really like to see, because that is a much less emotional, much more objective process. And I think what we're looking for here is we're looking for governments and regulators to have sufficient controls to be able to provide measured but substantive penalties against organisations that have suffered breaches. Yeah, if we look back over the various instances over the years, let's take that Red Cross Blood Service again, because that's a good example of where they were dependent on a third party. The third party left the data exposed somewhere. In a case like that, I think you could make a very strong argument that the Red Cross themselves did pretty much everything right. Now, assuming they had sufficient processes for how they identified and selected the vendor and the controls which they then imposed on the vendor, but someone beyond their control did something stupid. Now, should they get a class action? Definitely not. Should they, because that data never spread anyway, it was sent to me and then I end up deleting the whole thing along with the guy that found it for various reasons related to the fact that it never went anywhere else. It was health-related data and the Red Cross did a great job of notifying everyone. I don't think we should be seeing class actions there. And I think based on what I know of that incident, I don't think we should be seeing any action by the regulator either. But then you look at Uber. Uber is a good example. Because they tried to cover up their data breach and pass it off as a bug bounty. Now, of course, there was regulator action against Uber and against their CTO for then trying to, CTO, CISO, for then, I think it was lying to investigators or misleading. Anyway, it didn't work out very well to him. But, you know, that's a case where you've really, really cocked up your data breach handling process and there should be penalties by the regulator. So I think you've actually summed up well what causes people to join class actions. And I don't agree, but I understand. Marek, I agree, but I do think substantial penalties fine should apply where a component was clearly negligent. Exactly what I just said. Well done, Marek. Stefan, Telstra that Scott got your email breached? Ah, okay. So what Stefan's referring to when he said something about Scott, just blame Scott for the Optus breach. The Optus breach happened just after Charlotte's and my wedding in September 2022. And Scott was out here. This is Scott Helm. Scott Helm was out here. And I remember clearly we're sitting in my car and we're driving along. And he's like, look, I've got to go and buy a SIM because his UK SIM doesn't work. I've got to go and buy a SIM. So he goes and gets an Optus SIM. I think he gets just one of the little packs off the shelf. And of course, you've got to identify yourself. This is one of the big problems that we had with the Optus data breach. You've got to provide identifiable information such that calls and things can be traced back to an individual, because who knows if you're going to do like terror shit or things like that with your SIM card. So it had asked for password information. He'd put in his UK information and it had rejected it. And then it said, you can provide an Australian credit card. And he's like, hey, Troy, can I use your credit card? And I'm like, well, you've come all the way to the other side of the world for my wedding. Yeah, of course you can. Here's my card. So he puts my card into the Optus website and there's the data breach. Now, mind you, there was no exposure of card details. I didn't rotate the card, never saw any fraudulent activities. So, but yeah, it was just funny that Scott somehow managed to get me tangled up in the Optus data breach. Marek says he religiously reports the use of Safe Browsing Project, which of course would be those phishing emails that do that. James, that's the device they put in the back of the vehicle. It's a mobile cell tower that just sends spam texts directly. Troy might be on their regular route at 2 a.m. Yeah, honestly, that is the first I've heard of that. To the best of my knowledge, people are just using SMS-based services that are online. That'd be kind of cool to think that there's someone like driving around here. I'm quite sure it's not that. If you have any evidence to that effect, though, please send me a link to it. Peter, think about emails costing 1 cent each. I believe those are called ads and could get lots more expensive. Imagine people sending bulk mail. That's 1 cent each. Thomas, data is gold. Minimize data retention and type of data collected. What is really needed to provide a service? Yeah, and that is spot on. And if we think about even just the data breaches I've spoken about today, how much of that data needed to be retained and for what period? I mean, here's a really interesting discussion. Someone Someone interviewed me the other day, or I'm going to be interviewed, about what they called, I think they called it zombie accounts. So let's imagine you bought a t-shirt in 2005 and you signed up on a website and you provided all of the information you need in order to buy the t-shirt, your name, your email address, you created a password because you need an account on the website, your home address because the t-shirt's got to be delivered, your phone number because that's normally a forward position, and of course your credit card details, not such a problem because all that's expired now. But you did all of that 19 years ago. And then you got the t-shirt and you never thought any more about it. And your account is just there for 19 years. Should these be purged at some time? I mean, you made the point here, Thomas, data is gold. Organizations don't want to purge that because they've got millions and millions of people's personal data here that is a potential pipeline for, let's say, marketing. The volume of information collected, this was one of the big fallouts of Optus. Did they really need to have driver's licenses, driver's license numbers, which they retained after the point of initial identification? Could there be something else which was used to then identify the individual without it being a piece of data which is used for identity proofs in other places? I was in the Latitude Financial data breach the beginning of last year. A data breach that was so old it went to my parents' address, which I hadn't lived at since the 90s. Apparently they still had my data. I can't even remember what loan it was I had from Latitude Financial, but my data was there. Crazy stuff. So yeah, and I love the old adage of you cannot lose what you do not have. If you do not have that data, you cannot lose. It's one of the reasons the only thing that goes into having a phone is email addresses. I cannot lose people's dates of birth and things like that if there's an entire compromise of all of the having phone cloud infrastructure. Like, that just doesn't exist there. Marek, I'm sure the time span SMS sent matters. The bank and the recipient is sleepy and follows link. Maybe it's just cheaper to send it at that time of day. I don't know. All right, let me wrap up here. That was the state of data breaches. I had a lot of feedback about that, which got me thinking about a follow-up. I started writing a follow-up yesterday because I think there's another interesting aspect here without giving the blog post away. I want to finish it probably over the weekend, but there's a really interesting set of communications that happen around data breaches involving the hacker, the corporate victim, the company that's been breached, and law enforcement. And I have this mental image of a triangle with the three of them, and then I'm sitting here in the middle of the triangle, often triaging backwards and forwards. And it's quite intriguing how each of those parties communicates with the other and where I often fit into that picture. And the balancing act that happens, the delicate, delicate balancing act that happens in the communication between all of them. So I'm writing up a follow-up to this because it's just, I just feel like this last week I've had this sort of stuff on the brain a lot, which is what prompted that blog post on Monday. James says, I'll tag you on Twitter when I find where I saw these. I think BHIS was talking about it on Monday. Yeah, let me know, mate. I'd be interested. Okay, this has been very long, and I started very late, and now it's almost midday. So thank you very much for watching this. I'll come back at the end of next week. There will be more breaches. This is just the way it is at the moment. And we'll talk about it then. See you later, folks.